Hi, and welcome once again to From the Center, a podcast by the Center for Western Studies. I'm Jack Vow, on faculty with the Center for Western Studies, joined as always by my friend and colleague, the director for the Center for Western Studies, John Hodges. Sir, good to see you again.
Ta-da! Today's a big day.
Blow the trumpet and the walls came crashing down.
The whole year came crashing down. No. We had a great time last night. Good to see you too, Jack. We had a great time last night with our closing dinner at the center, and so we're both free. We're thinking, now what? What do we do now with our time?
Yeah, there's a vast expanse of nothingness stretching before us in existential dread and horror. Yeah, it is weird. There's something about while the semester or the year or the whatever is going on, you're sort of in it no matter how tired you are.
Yeah.
But then when it's over, it's like your body is like, are we done? We're done? Okay. Everything shut
now
down.
Now we can call it off.
We're turning the brain off. It won't turn back on until August.
Can sleep in until 6:30. Be wild.
Wow.
Well, it is a little bit of a relief to have all of it over, but at the same time, it's a little sad to see everybody go and see the end of the year. You know, we had such a good year with our students this year.
They're like 9-10 months with each other, including on a two and a half week trip somewhere.
Yeah.
It's like family by the end of it. It's
absolutely.
Like, yeah, inside jokes and stuff that no one else gets.
Right.
Like the best part of the dinner last night was when you were giving one of our students his little certificate that we give them, and there was an inside joke.
Oh, yeah.
So, like, all the middle names we'd give them. No one else got it except, like, the five of us.
That's
like,
right.
Me, you, and
that's
the three
right.
students.
And the three students. Well, he had been called by so many different names by, you know, we'd introduce him at the, say, the LaBrie retreat, and the fellows at LaBrie could never remember his name. So we just, whatever they called him, we just added to his middle name. So suddenly he had all these, this string of middle names.
Right.
And it was very funny. Well, it was a good year, and I'm glad to see the next chapter opening up for our students. They're going to be going off to college and off to new plans and new jobs and things, and it'll be exciting to hear how they do. I hope they'll stay in touch, as so many of them do. You know, we have such a crew now. That was probably our ninth year of doing this, and so that means we've got a lot of students out there who are checking back in with us, letting us know how they're doing. And we had three of the former students there last night, didn't we?
You know, after we do a 10th year, we have to do a 10-year reunion.
We do, don't we?
We do.
That's one of those job rules.
We have to summon all as many former students as can to come together.
Good idea.
And reminisce.
Yeah.
I'm full of them.
You're full of,
full of good
people
ideas.
Have said that about you, but I thought they meant something else.
I'm sure they did. I always have to clarify.
No, I wasn't them. It wasn't plural. It was full of it, I think they said. I'm just being silly.
We're both a little
loopy. We're a little loopy.
We are legitimately fried. We are. And I mean, it's not just frying because it's like hard work or something like that. It is, but the stuff we talk about, and this isn't trying to be a center plug day or something like that. But
feel free.
Because the dinner was last night, I guess it's fresh in our minds.
Sure.
Going through the year, the stuff that we teach is limited because we have limited time. You know,
right,
like we've said it before, having like only like maybe 9 months to try and jam in stuff from Homer to to postmodernism.
Yeah,
is ridiculous. And there's so much stuff that gets left out that we love to talk about. But also, it's limited because we know what we like and what we care about. And part of our pedagogy is that teachers teach best when they teach stuff they actually like.
Absolutely.
Right. So it's like it's stuff we like. And so there's a lot of, emotional attachment to the things that we teach. The stuff that we, while we're teaching it, can get jazzed about.
Right.
And the kids can see you get jazzed about it, which I think is good teaching practice. Because, like, even if they don't quite understand what you're talking about, they'll at least get a sense of, you know, whatever they're on, I want to be on it too, you know, kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
So it's going through all these things and experiencing them again and again, sometimes being refreshed by remembering something about it, sometimes catching something you didn't see before.
Right.
Sometimes, and this is, for me, is like where sometimes it takes the cake, is being able to experience new things in our one-on-one tutoring sessions. That's usually where we supplement things. But we go through those things, and we're always jazzed about it. And so to go through them and to go through those heights of interest in them, and then when it's all done, it's kind of like coming down off of a high in some ways.
Yeah. You had a really good tutorial series with one of our students about Lewis's space trilogy, didn't you?
Oh, yeah.
I remember, what did you get out of that?
Well, I remember when he broached it to me, I was like jazzed and terrified at the same time because I was like, the whole trilogy? Like,
did you guys read all three of them?
All three.
We
went through all three, which was ridiculous. But we had enough weeks to ostensibly read it and talk about it. But I mean, when you read any of those books, there's like moment, like the trouble we kept running into is that we would sit down and instead of like going through the book, we just had to show up and like he would have a section he wanted to talk about and I'd have a section and that was it.
Because that's all you could do.
That's all you could do. There are just moments where like Ransom's talking to like one of the one of the creatures on Mars or you know. In that hideous strength, almost like every sequence and scene, something is going on. And it just was mind blowing, the whole thing. So I was kind of terrified because I was like, my gosh, how are we going to do this? But getting that sense of how dense those works are seemed to be its own reward. I know the student was like having his mind exploded most every page, and I was having it too. Mm-hmm. The big thing for me was that hideous strength because. Before I did the tutoring thing this year, I had read it twice before, once for class and back in college, and once just because I felt like I needed to read it again.
Yeah.
And the reason I felt like I needed to read it again is because the first time I read it, I didn't get it.
Oh.
All right.
Right.
I mean, I enjoyed it. It had a lot of good moments and really memorable moments. But on the whole, I thought it was like the weaker of the three books because it just had so much stuff.
The third one.
Yeah, the third one. It had so much stuff and felt top heavy and like a little unwieldy. And I was like kind of hard to follow the story and so on and so forth. But I came back around the second time. I was like, well, let me give this thing another chance. So I read it a second time and still felt kind of the same way for some reason. It still was like amazing. Now I got more out of it because I was paying attention because I was able to go on my own pace. So it was even more incredible in a lot of ways. But still felt kind of slow here, kind of whatever there, so on and so forth. For this tutoring sequence, I wanted to read it a third time because it was so big. I wanted to make sure I got it.
Yeah.
All right. I just want to make sure. So over the Europe trip, I took it with me and read it like on the planes, trains, not on automobiles because they make me sick. But I read it a third time. And for some reason, this third time around is when it all finally gelled. Yeah. Like the whole thing gelled. Even the slow parts, you see the quotation marks I make with my hand. The comment, for those who don't know, because they've never read the Space Trilogy and thus are Philistines, the third book of the Lewis's Space Trilogy, That Hideous Strength, often has one common complaint, and that is that the first half of it is really slow. Because it's building a lot of stuff, and there's a lot of, like, insider baseball intrigue of like academia and like politics and bureaucracy and a setting of the stage of a lot of stuff. And then somewhere around a little after halfway, it starts to pick up with like this, like, you know, Merlin shows up, spoilers, and like a bunch of other stuff starts happening. And then it really gets going and it rolls to a very satisfying conclusion.
Yeah, it certainly does get intense at the end. So it makes up for any slowness at the beginning.
So I experienced that twice, but coming back to it a third time where I really, I mean, I was on a plane, like a 7-hour plane ride. What are you going to do? So I just like very slowly got into it. For some reason, this time it really kind of, I don't know what it was. Maybe it's because I was married reading it. I mean, the story, the heart of the story is like Mark and Jane.
Exactly right. That's right. About what I was going to say. I was going to say the slow part at the beginning is really about the difficulties of their marriage and his work and what kind of relationship they're going to have and feminism and all sorts of crazy things.
All sorts of crazy. It sets up, I mean, the whole story is about their individual redemption and each of their own individual redemptions and then the redemption of their marriage coming back together. That's really what the story is all about.
It's a beautiful story.
So maybe being married myself made
a difference.
Intriguing and interesting.
Sure.
Maybe there are other factors too, but somehow that really opened up for me that now, I don't know, Hodges, I used to say Paralandra was my favorite, but now I don't know. It has unsettled me. in the sense that I just loved it. Like I was, what he and I did over our tutoring sessions is we said, well, for that hideous strength, the sections we're going to look at is let's look at Jane's redemption and then let's look at Mark's redemption.
Excellent.
And exactly how that happened.
Right.
Because
right.
it was fast, because it was two different ways. It was like two different sides of the same coin, but two different ways that it went about.
Because in the story, they, in a sense, get geographically separated, don't they?
Yeah.
So their individual redemptions actually happen separately. And then at the end, there's a way for them to come back together again.
Yeah.
And redeem their marriage as a whole.
Yeah, and it was interesting because they both, it's like they have the same problem, and yet it was like a unique problem to themselves.
That's right.
They're both selfish sounds a little too simple, because it was more complicated than that. But there was this kind of, they wanted to control their environment and their life the way they wanted to control it.
That's right. That's exactly right.
And yet they genuinely loved each other in some way. And so it was like how to square that circle, which they couldn't. They had to learn how to let go in some way. Jane had to learn how to let go of herself. I don't know how else to say it other than by learning how to not take herself so daggum seriously, which is what she wanted, to recognize herself as someone who is a creature created by a God who has purposes for her that are bigger than her, right? And that,
that's right.
And, you know,
that's
maybe
right.
he doesn't. There was some image where she said maybe she wanted to be taken very seriously, but maybe in the end she really was just like a little kid wanting to be taken seriously in front of a bunch of adults.
That's right.
And
that's right.
Maybe God is the adult that, you know, and has their own sort of vision. I'm butchering it because it was powerful, because she basically, her final redemption happens with like a theophany. Basically, she meets Christ in a moment, like in a garden somewhere, of course, for a moment. And that sort of blows her mind. Mark meets Christ as well, but he meets Christ on the cross, the crucifix that Frost wants him to step on. And I pointed out to Devin how it's interesting that Jane was confronted by the God man, and Mark was confronted by the God man, like the man side of it, which was interesting. It was like Mark, because Mark, like, it makes a big deal constantly, like he doesn't believe in religion, he's not a supernaturalist, blah, blah, blah. So that avenue is closed to him, so it's almost like redemption reached him through a material sort of way. That was the way to get him. Anyway, it was focusing on how they were redeemed and how Mark finally learned to love his wife, and Jane finally learned to... Basically, they both had to learn a different kind of humility, which is so important to the balancing act of, like, the balancing act, to the balance of, like, what a marriage is to be. And the way he, like, seemed to nail feminism's concerns, like, right on the head, like, just seemed to get it, like, Jane, you know, not wanting to feel bartered like cattle or something like that between men and kings. It's almost like Lewis got it. Like, he wasn't trying to be sarcastic or...
Funny. No, he recognized that it's a very real human concern. And it's interesting, too, isn't it, that that the feminist questions back in the 40s or 50s when he wrote that are not that different than they are today.
All right.
So, yeah, Lewis has a lot of insight. Did you find that that our student, Devin, got a hold of those ideas? Did that blow his mind?
Yeah, it did. It blew it in such a way that it was hard for him to express. But, I mean, it was pretty much, when you walk through it step by step, especially Marx, we really walked through it step by step, because he has, like, not because Jane doesn't have step by step, but because we did Jane's, and then we're like, wait a minute, there's so much more to Jane's. Darn it, we don't have enough time. Let's just unpack Marx. But Marx, we went step by step through his times in the cell and his thoughts to himself, dealing with Frost, dealing with the objective room.
That's an astonishing moment, isn't it?
Yeah, that idea of the objective room, which is objectivity is the destruction of, like, all sort of emotional attachment to things.
Affection.
Right? Any sort of affection to, like, to your innate sort of desire for harmony and order and things coming together gets in the way of making you an efficient machine, right? So you have to kill it out of you by so bombarding you with things that are off that you just don't want to. You just don't want it anymore.
Broken patterns, wrong angles, wrong ratios of room size and
stuff off by just a little bit.
Paintings, everything off by just a little bit. Yeah, exactly. That was enough to. They were sure that that was going to be enough to send him over the edge. And
it actually had the opposite effect.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it made him. Yeah. It said that having an image of the crooked finally brought into his mind the image of the straight.
Right.
He's right. Like, whatever that is, the normal, like he wanted it very badly.
And when your affection is attached to the straight and true, and you recognize that that's the only way you could know that these things aren't straight and true, then it changes you. It changes things. You either have to give up your affection, or you have to embrace that affection and recognize that these are off, and I want the thing that's straight, like you say. I think Lewis actually went through that himself. That's a very autobiographical, not so much objectivist room or whatever you call it, but the idea that it dawned on me. I think one of his is it Surprised by Joy, someplace in there he says, it dawned on me one day, how do I know that these things are wrong? Because he hated God, if there were a God at all, but he also was very upset at all the wrongs that were going on in the world, as so many are even today, right? Yeah. You hear so many people rightly saying, I want justice for this or that issue. But the question is always, how do you know that's wrong unless you know that there's a right out there? And that changes your attachment to a transcendent truth.
Yeah, it's an interesting... Sometimes I get jealous of Lewis because I keep more and more finding that the way he writes as a storyteller is how I want to write, which I sometimes hate to say because tons of people will say that and then they just become like Lewis knockoffs, basically. Oh, that's not what I mean. I don't want to like sound exactly like him, but he could take a complex abstract thing and somehow turn it into a riveting story. I mean, with Mark, like the back end of Mark Studdick's story and That Hideous Strength is really like a step-by-step unpacking of like a moral conversion without the gospel ever being mentioned once.
Interesting.
Right. Yeah. And it's technically him becoming moral and even in a way becoming sort of Christian without him knowing it, but he's like unpacking this very complex, okay, taking an assessment of yourself, getting to the bottom of yourself, analyzing what's really wrong, seeing how it is really wrong, then seeing the depths of what it is, what that thing, seeing your helplessness before it, then being confronted by crookedness and you wanting the normalcy. All that stuff is this really complex, abstract thing. Mm-hmm. And somehow he's able to take it and turn it into a story that holds you. Like, I feel like if someone else wrote something like that and gave it to like an editor, they'd say that there would be an instinct to be like, where's the story? Nothing's happening. He's just sitting there thinking. You know, and stuff like that. And yet it's the most riveting thinking all, because it felt he was able to articulate these things in such a way that they held you.
Yeah.
And I'm in my own storytelling, you know, I care about ideas and because I believe they have consequences and thus they make good, you know, they're good for storytelling, if nothing else. Stories basically are concrete ideas. You know, ideas make concrete in some way, even shallow ideas. But the ability to do that, to articulate something like that and it still be a riveting story, I mean, putting it in science fiction fantasy context helps in a way because, like, there's a sort of sense of, like, you're dealing with weird things that need to be explained anyway. But still, to do it in such a way that doesn't put people asleep and still just profoundly unpacks what's happening and yet doing it believably. That's the thing. It's like, on the one hand, you feel like you're hearing Lewis, you know, articulating something lecture style. And at the same time, you feel like you're hearing Mark think about these things specifically. Right. Somehow it's still specific to him, even though you understand the general idea.
That's the art of it, isn't it? That's the art of writing, because you can have an idea and not be able to encapsulate it or incarnate it the way it needs to be done. And Lewis, I think one of Lewis's great strengths in general is that he's able to take abstract, difficult concepts and put them in analogous form or in parable-like form or finding some sort of a pictorial way to say it. You know, even in his nonfiction, that's what he does. He'll say the point, and then he'll say it's like this, and he says it's like ice on a cold day or something, and suddenly you get it all. You know, you get it all. So he has that ability. That's one of his great abilities, I think, taking complex things and making them understandable to laymen like me. who are, you know, not able to grasp it at the.
It's almost like he believed there was some sort of connection between the material and the immaterial.
Well, what a concept! But that also, I think, extends into his ability to write these stories too. I'll go on record as saying I don't think he's the greatest writer, fiction writer.
Sure.
Or certainly not poet or anything. And I'm grateful that he did those stories. I love those stories. Don't get me wrong. I love those stories, but I don't think he's the. You know, he's not a Tolkien. Tolkien actually did have a kind of multifaceted storytelling ability. But what Lewis does have, and this is, I think it outshines most anybody in the 20th century, is this ability to take this concept and put it in an analogous form or in a metaphorical or parable-like form. Anyway, some way to say, see, I can't do it myself. I pride myself on being able to come up with an analogy for a concept. But I'm in doing that, I'm imitating Lewis. I'm trying my best to imitate, look up to Lewis.
Yeah.
Well, those sorts of things are really important. I'm glad that Devin was getting some of that. I hope that it blew his mind as much as it does ours. I've always loved that book. I think of the three of them, that's my favorite. There are bits of Perelandra that are exquisite, absolutely exquisite. But the third book, in telling the story of Jane and Mark and their redemption and their marriage, through this recognition of something higher than themselves, they each come into contact with something that, in a sense, gives them humility. Proper humility, not just thinking like I'm a worm, but recognizing that there is something that I can join with, something I can be a part of, that is bigger than I am. And that gives such depth of meaning to life.
Yeah.
But it also, I think, shows a very good picture of evil. The nice, the N-I-C-E, is so clearly evil. But it's so insidious. It grows on you so slowly, you know, until at the beginning, all the things they're doing seem to be so attractive to Mark. You know, he wants to be on the inside. One of the real problems that I think young men deal with all the time is this desire to be accepted into the sphere at work, you know, in their fields, in their societies. I want to be on the inside. I want to be part of the inner circle. And Lewis does such a great job describing that hunger, that the way you can cut, you want to cut corners, the way you want to laugh at the wrong joke, the way you want to help them see that you're one of them, that you're willing to do almost anything to be on the inside. He wrote a great little article about that once, a little essay called the Inner Circle.
The Inner Ring.
Thank you. It's Solzhenitsyn wrote The Inner Circle.
Right.
That's right.
Lewis Solzhenitsyn.
I know.
Get him confused.
I can't
regularly.
Spell either one of them.
One's bald, one has a beard. Just, you know, that works.
But anyway, I thought that idea of the temptation to want to be on the inner circle and be willing to compromise your beliefs, compromise your virtue, compromise to get that is extremely high. And it's much more insidious and incremental, you know, than somebody coming up to you and saying, you have to shoot your dog, you know, and you go, well, I'm not going to do that. But if you work at it little degree at a time, you know, then you can get to the point where you realize you're about ready to shoot your dog just to be in with the right people, you know, or something. Well, he gets that. He really gets that. And Mark has to go through that. And eventually there's this tremendous moment where the fellow he has been counting on to lead him and to be to take him into that inner circle really turns on him, and when he turns on him, it's almost sadistic. If you remember, I think it's Feverstone, and he says something. He smiles at him and says something like, "Welcome to the big leagues," you know, or this is how it works, you know.
Right, something like that.
You fool! You trusted in me. You're a hopeless. That's what he says. You're a hopeless romantic.
Yeah.
Oh man. And then he pops something in his mouth, you know, something he's eating, a muffin or something. It is, as though this is nothing, and I eat people like you for breakfast, basically. You know? It's a devastating moment in my mind. I remember that like it was burned in my head, my mind. And it just gets worse from there for him, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. Well, I love that story for all those reasons. I also love the story for the way it describes Ransom and the people that are good, the ones that are around him. Everyone is there because he chooses to be. Nobody's being manipulated or pressured.
Yeah.
So there's a free association like that. I know this is on a small scale, but I like to think that the group that meets here on Sunday nights is, in a sense, a free association. Mm. Everybody comes because they want to come, and they want to be a part of the conversation, and on our Sunday night dinners I'm talking about.
Right.
And
it's not compulsion. It's loyalty to a common thing.
And even so, I try to bend over backward to let people know that they are welcome here, but that we don't expect them to be here every week because people have busy lives. Even on that small level, I don't want them thinking, gee, it's Sunday and I don't want to look like I don't want to come. I don't want even that pressure on them,
you know?
I want them to come because they really want to be here, and it's a free association. It's that same sort of spirit, I'd like to think, that we're doing. And I think we inculcate that in our students, too, I think. Anyway, I'm glad you guys talked about that hideous strength. There's so many moments through the year that address important ideas. I thought maybe it'd be fun to talk through some of the other ones. Go back to the Odyssey for a minute. You know, the beginning of the year, we usually start off with the Odyssey. The beginning of the year,
the beginning of this podcast series, we started with the Odyssey.
That was one of the first ones anyway. Yeah, sure enough. I'm just thinking about how it dawned on me even as we were doing it. I suppose this is several years ago it dawned on me, and we try to get that across this year too. But I think it dawned on me that one of the essential virtues of the Greek world in the Odyssey, the world that the Odyssey describes, with all of its magic and all of its gods and goddesses and all of that, one of the essential sort of foundational principles is this idea of hospitality. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, well, that's nice. They want people to be nice to each other. You know, I think, well, okay, we don't do that so much. I guess we have people over to dinner like we do or something. There's a sort of hospitality that goes on. But why would it be such a big deal, you know, to the Greeks? So much so that if you didn't act a proper host, then the gods would be against you.
Yeah.
If you didn't act a proper guest, the gods would be against you, right? This guest-host relationship was essential.
Right. Even violently against you.
Exactly. It was really a big breach of etiquette, right? And you think, well, it's like saying you didn't use the right napkin. You know, you didn't put the fork on the right side of the plate, and so we're going to throw, you know, lightning bolts at you or something.
Or Odysseus is going to reveal himself and slaughter you wholesale.
Exactly, to put it on the nose.
The hooded man in the corner throws back his hood, and it's Hodges. He's like, aha, it was me all along. And then he just slaughters.
And I start hacking away. Yeah, that would be horrific.
Be a Sunday night to remember.
Sunday, bloody Sunday. Well, but I mean, it occurs to me that as we started talking about, you know, as we discussed hospitality and how what a big part it played in that, we started thinking, well, you know, there are a lot of references in the Old Testament to hospitality. Mm. You know, Abraham and the part of the problem with the story of Lot and the Sodom and Gomorrah story was that the people of Sodom actually were not hospitable.
Right.
Right? They did things that were anti-hospitable. So why is that why wasn't it that they murdered this poor woman, this poor girl, you know? Well, that was an example, in a sense, of lack of hospitality. Is hospitality that big a deal? See what I mean? So, but then we started talking about it, and it turned out that the relationship between God and his people is one of hospitality. That is, God is offering something, and we need to respond to it in the right way. So, in a sense, the truly center of the gospel, the center of the universe and the relationship between the created universe and its host, is depicted in this way of hospitality. And I think that was kind of mind-blowing to our students.
It's like, I mean, hospitality... It's not just someone shows up and you like make sure they have a cup of lemonade.
Right.
You know, it's more like when a stranger shows up at your door or a traveler, or whether you know them or not, you treat them like they're a member of the household.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's like a welcoming into the house, you know.
That's right.
And giving them like full attention and care, the old idea that you feed them and bathe them and clothe them before you ever ask their name.
Very interesting point,
kind
because
thing, right?
that's what it is that God does with us too. We say he doesn't wait for you to get yourself cleaned up and fed and get yourself all right before he accepts you.
Right.
It's the other way around, right? His grace is to say, I love you and I embrace you. And now, once you're mine and you recognize, you know, like the prodigal coming home, that you are accepted here and that you are going to be feasted here and life is, that you're safe and welcomed and so on. And it's out of a gratefulness for that hospitality, as it were, mm-hmm. that we want to change, do away with our bad habits, do away with our sinful nature.
Right. I mean, at the root of hospitality is hospital. And the very idea of hospital, I think, like root-wise, it has the idea of a host. Like somebody's hosting you. It's like I said, it's not just like the give someone a cup of lemonade thing, although if you give a cup of cold water, you know, it's still good. It's the idea of like someone showing up is reason to celebrate in some ways. Like it's reason to throw on a meal and, you know, bust out the sheets and like we're having a visitor and a guest and like I'm not sure party's the right word, but it's something like that.
Yeah.
It's like you now are a part of the household, and thus the response of the guest is so important, because then it's like you're being treated this way. Gratitude ought to be the natural response to like being not just given a, you know, like, well, here, we're going to give you a, you know, we'll give you like a glass of lemonade again. I'm in the South, so I'm just thinking.
Sure. Sure.
But we're going to treat you like you're one of our children or you're one of our family in some way when you're not. I mean, yes, it creates like a social order. It maintains like, you know, everybody's not at each other's throats. It maintains a kind of civility. But there is something kind of astonishing about someone comes to your door. You don't know them from Adam, but you're supposed to treat them like you know them, like utterly know them. And the parallel between, you know, that and the idea of the gospel, I mean, it should be kind of obvious. I mean, we're adopted, right? We're adopted by God. He literally brings us, because of Jesus, he brings us into his house.
Yes.
And we, who were his enemies, get treated like your children, like your sons and daughters.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's an even more radical kind of version of it. It's like if your enemy knocked on your door and you let them in and treated, like that's... I mean, on a practical human plane, that sounds stupid. Like, why would you
right.
do that?
Don't
and
invite
yet God,
your enemy in.
And yet God did that.
Yeah.
It's like if on that level, if you were his enemy and yet instead of crushing you, he invites you into his house and like, you know, lets you eat at his table like David did with Mephibosheth. How's that for obscure Old Testament reference?
Nicely done.
If you do that, why wouldn't you have gratitude? Like like astronomical gratitude.
Right.
It is kind of amazing. I mean, you see it in the Greek world. And you see it in the Old Testament world with like Abraham and Melchizedek, and then like Lot, or like Abraham with like the strangers who came, and one of them maybe one of them was God, you know, this way, and like the way the people of Sodom handled people, and the rules about how to treat like, you know, the poor and your neighbor and strangers and stuff like that, and into the New Testament with the idea of the gospel and like, you know, those who were hospitable to Jesus who have received him and the cup of cold water. You put all that together, and like we said with Paul, who's sort of the merging of like Athens and Jerusalem together in one person, it's not surprising that the sort of Christian world that grows out of that, I mean, it's amazing when you get to the bottom of like, say, you get all go fast forward like up to like Dante, all right, and you're at the Inferno, And you're going through all these horrible things as you're going like further and further down.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to tell the kids that when you're reading the Inferno, you can't see each of the sins as like just this isolated weirdness. You have to see them, A, as whatever's punishment is going on is actually befitting of the sin, because mm-hmm. it kind of is the sin mm-hmm. fully mm-hmm. realized. Mm-hmm. So in the circle of the lustful, for example, they're constantly caught in whirlwinds and mm-hmm. being thrown around. And I'm showing them that's basically, it's trying to show you that's what lust is. If you're mm-hmm. dominated by lust, there's no rest. You're just constantly restlessly flying around from one thing to another. And it's like having a whirlwind inside your soul type thing. So right. you have to see that. But the second thing you have to see is how all these things connect, how there's a moral trajectory. It's not just the isolated things. It's that the murkiness of mind that Dante has at the beginning leads you to kind of a neutrality that's not really sure whether you pick good or evil. And in that moral neutrality, it's easy for you to fall into bad mm-hmm. stuff. It's easy for you to fall into lusting after another person and then lusting after stuff in general and then lusting after money. And then when that doesn't satisfy you, you're just filled with rage and despair. That's not satisfying you. If you don't repent, you just harden your heart to go further mm-hmm. and you try to use all the powers you have to control your environment. And
including
then
your mind.
Including your mind.
Start using your mind to figure out how you can get the things you want.
Right. And so you become more destructive and more violent to try and control things. And then you realize that the wisest or the best way to control things is not through violent force, but through your mind. And so yeah. now you become treacherous and deceitful
exactly.
and manipulative. It's just this horrible trajectory that goes all the way down. And when you get to the final circle, the ninth circle, it's where you have the worst of the worst, which are the traitors, basically, people who have betrayed. But there's like four levels of traitors, right? There's like the first level of those who betrayed their families, mm-hmm. which that one seems pretty like obvious. Like, yes, you betrayed your father, your mother, your brother, you stabbed him in the back, you whatever. But then it goes deeper. Like, there's further things. The next one deeper is betrayal of your country, mm-hmm. which I explained to the kids, that's like betraying every family.
Uh-huh.
That you live
with. Not just your family, but all the families in your community.
Right.
Right.
And it's like, well, what's worse than that? And it's like, well, the next step is the betrayal, the host betraying their guest.
That's right.
Is like the next worst thing. And when you tell the kids that, whether it's the center or when I've taught it elsewhere, they're kind of, really?
Yeah, how can like, that be well, the
like,
worst
I,
thing?
Like, that's the worst thing? I mean, look, I mean, isn't lust like worse? Isn't that like, yeah. you know, aren't we all mad at like, you know, pornography and what it does? And it's like, yes, but pornography and lustful sins are often really obvious. Well, this thing is a much more insidious, deep. Mm-hmm. It's like it begets pornography.
Mm-hmm.
All right,
mm-hmm.
you know, a purveyor of pornography is a bad host to his guests. Right?
Well, yeah,
he's giving them poisonous, toxic things.
Right.
But there was an
right.
even further evil, and it was like the greatest evil was the inversion of it. And that was, it's a guest who betrays their host, who betrays their benevolent host. That was actually
absolutely.
The worst
that's
of the worst.
The worst thing that can happen. And, of course, that's Satan's reaction to God, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
God himself is the ultimate host, and Satan's reaction against him, his betrayal of him, is the worst possible sin.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good picture. It's a great picture, in fact. That whole picture of good and evil and depicted and how the punishments actually are an extension of the crime, as it were, mm-hmm. kind of the natural fruit almost of the crime. That's one of the great things about Dante, his insight to that.
One of the reasons I like to teach Dante is it gives that sort of broad moral spectrum. Like uh-huh. it shows like good and evil and like all its different varied colors and shapes mm-hmm. and sizes. And when I say good, I'm talking about the whole of the Divine Comedy. You get up to Purgatory and Paradiso, you see what the good looks like. In contrast, in Inferno, you got this full spectrum of like evil in its individual states, as well as how they're all connected together.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and it still applies to today. Like there was one batch of students. One of the assignments I gave them was they were both huge anime nerds, and so I said, "Can you? We're going to go through each of those circles, and I want you to tell me like what anime villain fits one of these circles."
Great idea.
And see if they could get all the way to the bottom. And
yeah.
It was an interesting discussion because they were like trying to figure out like how these characters actually exemplify those things. And the bottom one, the idea that like betrayal is like the ultimate evil, and the ultimate act of betrayal is a guest betraying their host, is not, I mean, people don't articulate it that way exactly. But I mean, if you watch like Les Mis and you see what like, you know, the musical or you read the book, but you see like Les Mis or, you know, you watch the movie. But anyways, you see like that's exactly what happens to Jean Valjean, right? He gets invited into the bishop's house and the bishop, right. Everyone else like kicked him out. But the bishop, without asking questions, just invites him in and gave him food, gave him the lion's share, gave him a bed and stuff to sleep on. And Jean Valjean's response is to steal from him and try and run away.
Right.
Right. And it's like that. It's like the ultimate act of evil. It's like when you see it there, it's like you can get the sense of why you would see that as like utterly, like who does that? Like who does that? It's not only, the way I describe it to the kids is it's not only evil, it's also stupid. Right, you have this guy who is willing to be good to you,
biting the hand that feeds you.
Right, you're biting the hand that feeds you. You're right. Cutting off your nose to spite your own face.
Sure,
it's a kind of self-destructiveness.
Yeah,
that's also really malicious and spiteful. In the book, Les Mis, you get a strong sense of his just the sort of spitefulness that has built up in him over the years, the sort of hatefulness that's been building up over the years. And it's only a very snarling, sneering, nasty, malicious sort of spirit that would even think to attack somebody who's doing them good.
Right, right.
And that's sort of like, how bad do you have to be in order to like want to strike out against the being something that's doing you good?
Mm-hmm.
Like not even that confusing good where it's like they're hurting you because they care about you or they're coming. No, it's like it's literally good. Like they're giving you food because you're hungry and there's no excuse.
Yeah.
Like something has gone morally, utterly morally perverse when that happens.
Yeah, it's right and good to oppose that. And the gendarmes bring him back to face the bishop, and the bishop actually does the unthinkable, absolutely unthinkable. He says, "You took the things I gave you. I gave you all of those bits of silver, those plates and things, but you left the candlesticks. You left the best ones here. I meant to give you these too. You walked off without them."
Yeah.
The gendarmes are completely flabbergasted. Who would give away all of the silver to this vagabond? Mm. One of the most marvelous moments in all of theater is that moment after the police leave, and the bishop has this little arietta, a little song that he sings to Valjean in the musical, and it's priceless. And he says, "I have bought your soul for God. I've done this. This is beyond the most evil thing you can think. That is this this rejection of the good by the guest is as evil as it gets. Certainly in Dante, that's right. And I think that's because Dante understood the biblical picture of God creating a beautiful angel and that angel turning on him, giving him everything that he was, including existence. And then being turned on by that guest, by that angel in Satan. So that if that's the greatest evil possible, then how could it be that God is even bigger than that? And that's what happens, isn't it? The bishop represents God's grace in that moment and gives him not only what he stole, but far more than he stole, and tells him this grace is a gift from God, and now you, in a sense, owe him your soul. That's a marvelous picture. And Valjean doesn't just say, "Oh, good, now I owe my soul to God, hooray," right? It's not a simple thing. He has this fantastic soliloquy where he wrestles with it. What can I do? This is beyond my comprehension. And eventually he assents to this claim that God has on his soul, and says, and basically is converted right there on the stage. It's one of the most marvelous moments in all of theater. But it's the picture of the redeeming of a soul, and it can only happen by way of that tremendous grace. You can't say, well, if somebody's committing the sorts of sins you find in the ninth circle of hell in Dante, well then, who could forgive you?
Yeah.
Who could ever do, you know, that? But that's the point. Even at that level, you can be redeemed, not because your sin isn't great. It's enormous. It's huge. It's as evil as evil can be. And yet God's grace is larger even than that.
That's why it's always when I'm teaching Dante, it's always important for me that I point out to the kids that as Dante and Virgil go down through the circles, they regularly take note of, or at least at multiple points to take note of, they go through like the portals that lead to the circles and the gates that they had to go through. But Dante keeps noticing that there's parts of the barriers between the circles that are broken through.
Mm.
And it looks like something smashed through them and it goes all the way down.
Mm.
And he like asks Virgil, what is that? And Virgil's like, I'm not sure. Not long after I came down to Limbo, some mighty spirit came down here and just plowed through every single thing. Virgil died not long before Christ was born.
Yes.
And so it's the harrowing of hell idea, which, whether it's like theologically accurate or not, the image is, it goes all the way down to the ninth circle.
Mm-hmm.
And when you go through this, it's almost like, you know, in Purgatory and Paradiso, you get the vision of redemption full bore.
Right.
In Inferno, however, it's more about damnation and the horror of it, but there's still this image of, even all the way down to the ninth circle, Jesus punched all the way through,
mm-hmm.
like all the way down to the bottom. Dante is still, the writer is still saying, even at that depth, you're still not beyond his reach.
The reach of God.
There is he can save to the uttermost, which the very Greek idea is that he can go all the way to the finish line.
Yeah.
Like as far as you can possibly, to where you, the actual end, and he's like, he can go all the way down to the end.
That's beautiful.
And pull you out.
What a mind that Dante could grasp that and put it, like Lewis, into his stories.
Yeah, I brought up the anime thing with those students because often find that it's easier for people to see why like lust and greed, you know, are like evil, and it's easy to manufacture it on a story. even if some people want to quibble over how bad lust really is. But people, you know, like, well, is, you know, is shacking up or like sleeping around, is it really that bad? All consensual, I'm not hurting anyone, you know? It is interesting, however, that Dante takes that thing and puts it like at the top, you know, like, it's evil and you see the evil and horror of it, but it's the least evil.
Right.
In some ways that makes it the most dangerous. Cause like there's an image of like Dante talks with Paolo and Francesca about their sin, and Dante hears their story, and it's so pitiful that he starts crying over them.
Hmm.
And Virgil, like, smacks him across the head and says, Dante across the head and says, what are you crying for them for? Or, like, he fainted. He was so sad. And Virgil, like, rebukes him for, like, you're not supposed to show sympathy for evil.
Right.
Right? At this stage. Like, if they were still alive, you know, have sympathy
that
and pity.
That would be different. You could hope for redemption in that sense, but once they're in...
But once they're here,
after they're dead.
The evil has been, like, perfected. It's like, you're not supposed to sympathize. It's like he's shown the danger of how these lesser sins are still evil, and they're also can be very dangerous because it's hard to see. It's like, it's interesting. It's like... Sometimes it's hard to see why they're bad up top.
Yeah.
And even the bottom stuff can sometimes be hard to see, if you understand what I mean. Because like lust and greed, we can easily point out an example. But when we say betrayal of your benefactor, examples don't rush to mind immediately, except for like maybe Les Mis. But in everybody's like common day experience, it's like, well, I don't really see that happening. And yet I think it's arguable that every sin is necessarily rooted in that in some way. Like if for no other reason than you do have one benefactor at all times, that's God. And every sin you do is a betrayal of him.
Yeah.
In some way. Every sin you do is a betrayal of the one who created you and has called you to be a specific thing.
That's right. And it may seem like sleeping around is only a sort of superficial sin, and I think in Dante's understanding, it is partly because it's in a sense a slavery to your appetites, you know, your desires that are sort of overwhelming you. It's an upside down order for a human being, right? But and so it's wrong. But what I think is deeper what really is much more like the sin of despising your benefactor, doing evil to your benefactor, is that we are given a picture in the scriptures of what marriage and sexuality is supposed to be about.
Mm-hmm.
See, and by deciding to sleep around myself, I'm actually dismissing that. I'm saying I know better. You see, and in that way, I really am being, you know, I'm abusive to my host. My host has given me my body to begin with. My host has given me my desires. My host has given me a framework in which those that body and desire should work, and I've rejected it.
Yeah, we're all. It only makes sense in a moral universe where you see we're all guests in God's house.
That's it.
Basically, like, that's it. It's like.
So every disobedience is a kind of an anti-host disobedience.
And even on like, a in smaller level, you know, the kid who like lies to their teacher about what they did with their homework.
Yeah.
I mean, at root, it's the same kind of your teacher is the host. You're in their house, which is the classroom, and they're trying to give you an education. Yes, individual teachers can be terrible. But I'm just saying in principle. It's the idea that you're basically betraying their trust by lying to their face about something. So it's like you can see how it actually permeates. All sin can be arguably some kind of betrayal on some level.
And a kind of a lack of hospitality or a rejection of the hospitality relationship between host and guest.
Right, because you can argue that. Well, maybe we're getting into the tall weeds now, but you can argue that the way civilization works is that we treat every person as like guest and host at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, like when we step into a public space, you step into a restaurant, you're treating that like if you're a good if you're a good cashier and a good cook, you're treating all the people who step into it like guests.
Right.
But if you're a good customer, you're treating yourself like I'm a guest and here's my host. And also, I'm going to treat this cashier like they're a guest in my personal space. So if like they're having if they're having a hard time, if they counted wrong, I'm not going to box their ears. I'm going to be gracious to them.
Right.
That whole sort of it's like hospitality actually is like a, the entire glue of like how we work.
Isn't that something?
Right. If the fundamental essence of who we are is relational, like we're built to be relational things because we're made in the image of a God who's Trinity, therefore he's in some mysterious way essentially relational, then hospitality is no small thing.
Mm.
It may actually be the very, I mean, the way Lewis describes it in the Space Trilogy, see how we bring it all back around? In Paralandra, the reason I like Paralandra so much is because, sidebar here, the reason I like Paralandra so much aside from it being not quite as dense as that Hideous Strength, was because when I first took literary theory class as an undergraduate, I took it with Dr. Callis.
Oh, yeah.
And I first got exposed to, like, post-structural, post-modern stuff, and I understood some of it. I got it, and I didn't like it. I was just like, I don't like this stuff. I don't like what it is. And Dr. Callis, he ended with that. Like, he took us through, like, a whole gambit of it. Like, he showed us, like, Plato's stuff on things and, like, Renaissance stuff and Kant's idea of things. Like, he gave us a whole slew of, like, literary theory. It wasn't just contemporary. But he ended with the contemporary. When he ended with it, the last day of class was him giving a response to the post-structuralist argument.
Yeah.
And his response was that last, our next to last chapter of Paralandra, where they talk about the Great Dance.
Oh, yeah.
Like they said, that was his. When Ransom says he's full of doubts and ignorance, and he just feels like, you know, where's the beginning or center of everything and stuff like that. And they talk about the dance and how everything is united all in the dance. And it was like this big answer to the post-structuralist question. I was like, wow. Anyway, that's why I like Paralandra, because it had that in there.
Yeah.
On a separate note, when I was teaching, when I was doing the tutoring thing with Devin, we got to Paralandra and we focused on that big doxology that Lewis has, because I don't know what else to call it. It's the last like dox thing he has, which is everyone in turn just says something about the Great Dance.
Mm-hmm.
And part of how the Great Dance works is it's like the whole of existence is built on this sort of giving and receiving, this give and take, this like leading and submitting in turn that just like goes on and on and on forever, all the way up to the very pinnacle of everything. And God, who in his Trinitarian nature is also giving and receiving, leading in that mysterious way.
Right.
And you can see that kind of give and take. I'm leading, and then I'm following, and then I hand you off to someone else, and then I'm leading, and then I'm following, and you're leading, and then we hand off. So that just sort of like dance.
Yes.
Hospitality comes out of that. The hospitality is this kind of dance where like I am the host and I am going to treat you graciously, as like, well, I am the guest and I'm going to treat you graciously with your stuff and be granted. And so, and then when I am at my own house and someone comes to me, then I shall be hospitable to them. Like, you know, Odysseus, again, tying back to Homer. See how we tie it all back together? This is what we mean by the thread, people. This is what we're talking about, the thread. Homer, in the Odyssey, Odysseus kills the suitors and he blinds the Cyclops.
Right.
Right? The suitors who are bad guests and the Cyclops who are bad hosts.
Exactly.
Right? It's like both of those things are... Say bad is like not right. It's like it's almost like somehow the essence of evil is mm-hmm. there. It's like mm-hmm. this unwillingness to dance. There's this this unwillingness to position yourself relationally with other people, and specifically God, you know, the person to not position yourself in relation to Him in any sort of right way, seems to be like the essence of what evil is in some way.
That's such a great point about how. Hospitality, which actually is at its essence between the Father and the Son within the Trinity, right? Between the two of them, and the three of them, including the Spirit, being the very power of that interaction. So, if that's at the very center of all things, you can see how ethics flows out of that. If you're being called to a dance, right, and you're called to being a host, that is, you're leading. At this point, and you're submitting at this point, you're being the follower, you're being the guest at this point, and that harmony and that give and take, where each has its own, his own, relation position. That is, when you lead, you're supposed to be caring about the one who's following. When you're following, you're supposed to be caring in a different way about the one who's leading and submitting yourself to, the leader. That's a very, intricate dance. And it requires a lot of selflessness on either side. Mm-hmm. But you can see how to break that dance in any way then would be the beginnings of what we define as good and evil. Mm-hmm. You see, because if your job is outlined and you don't do it, if you're the Cyclops and you refuse to be a good host, that's wrong. If you're the suitors and you refuse to be good guests, that's wrong. So good and evil, right and wrong, become very clear that way. It all comes not from a series of rules. If you think that right and wrong is ultimately a series of rules, then you're still a step or two away from the truth.
Right.
The truth is that there's a dance going on, and it's a dance of love.
Right. It's behind the rules. There's a reality.
That's right.
Right. It's not the ethics is not. You say that if you have this Trinitarian thing, you know, ethics would come out of that. That's a natural step because your ethics comes out of your metaphysic.
That's right.
I mean, that's, you know, that's Aristotle, for goodness sake. His metaphysic and then his ethic is built right out of it. You know,
Makes sense. The
idea of things moving towards a right end.
That's right.
So understanding what a thing is so you can figure out where its right end is. And once you figure that out.
Okay.
And I was just saying that in that Hideous Strength with Mark and Jane, it's both similar. They both have to, they're refusing to dance, mainly with each other. You know, Jane, even though they love each other. But yet Jane wants to, you know, she sees Mark as like, she loves him, but she also sees him as kind of this impediment to her being taken seriously.
Uh-huh.
And she wants to
oppressive.
Some kind of oppressive thing. Well, yeah. Mark sees Jane as basically a trophy wife that can help him in his career.
Mm-hmm.
And they both have this image of each other that's either they're an obstacle or they're a tool, and that's it.
Uh-huh.
You know, but they're not a dance partner.
Right.
And it's interesting that Jane's redemption involves her... They both have to learn humility, but Jane's redemption comes from learning humility before God.
Mm-hmm.
Like, she has that humility. Mark's is actually learning humility before Jane. And it's this, what Lewis called the humility of a lover, all right? It's like him recognizing, like Mark starts to recognize, he starts to see Jane for the wonderful, beautiful person that she is, and he thinks of how he's, I mean, Lewis is very delicate with it, but he thinks of how he's treated her, like, sexually, you know, like as a husband, how he just kind of clumsily, like he didn't know what he had.
Uh-huh.
And it's this great image. This is a great image of him. He suddenly comes to himself, like, and near the end. He's escaped from the nice, and he's really thinking about things. And he thinks about, like, he suddenly sees Jane as, like, the thing all the poets talked about.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, and I neither knelt like, you know, a true knight, nor swaggered in like a Don Juan. I just was this clumsy oaf who didn't know what I had. And I just like said, how could I possibly have done that? Like, I didn't deserve I wasn't worthy of her at all. It's almost like he has a prodigal son sort of, I'm going to go home and tell him to, you know, make me my servant kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it's like,
it's beautiful.
And it's that notion of like the dynamic of husband and wife doesn't work without that fundamental humility before each other and before God.
Mm-hmm.
So in some way, you can't dance you can't do the real dance without that humility. Mm-hmm. I know, because I've been to the rumba room here in Memphis and got partaken in like free salsa lessons because a friend of mine was having a birthday party there and I had no choice. and so I was, and the way they did it was all the beginners, like they made two circles, like a ring and then another ring where everyone was facing each other. So like the inner ring is facing the outer ring and the outer ring is facing the inner ring.
Uh-huh.
And they just taught you a very simple a salsa move or something real quick. It might've been the salsa.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't the tango, but they like taught us like the move and we did it real quick. You danced with that person. And once you did it a couple of times, they stopped and they told like the inner ring to rotate one over. And so you had to do a completely
different person. Sure.
And it's just this constant, just two strangers. Just think about that. Two strangers have to like touch each other and move in harmony with each other in this context of if you are a prideful, narcissistic person, not only are you going to have a miserable time, but the person you're dancing with is going to have a miserable time too. It's like in order for the thing to work, in order for the thing to even be fun, you have to not take yourself serious. You just have to not, you just have to like, okay, you didn't just be awkward and be silly and actually try and be gracious and forgiving and patient. Because that's the way the dance works. Even like in a simple thing like that.
That's beautiful.
You have to be hospitable.
What a great picture. What a great metaphor for marriage in general.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. That's great. Well, how about some recommendations? Do you,
sure.
You want to think of one?
Well, I guess I...
Because, do you have one for us?
I mean, because I lauded on about it, I guess I'd say I would recommend the Space Trilogy. And I would specifically recommend That Hideous Dream. I'm actually going to specifically recommend that as someone who had to give it multiple chances in order to appreciate it. If you've never read it before, read it slow, take your time, recognize that it's really about Mark and Jane and their redemption, and all the other stuff is just fun stuff that's sort of precipitating that. But recognize that, take your time, take it slow, recognize that each section matters. And so pay attention in each section. If you've read it before and you found it a slog or you found it, not sure, I encourage you to read it again. I was one of you. It was the third time was literally the charm. And it took long plane rides and being married probably that helped. But give it a second chance. So my recommendation is not just That Hideous Dream. My recommendation is for those of you who gave it a chance and felt a little underwhelmed by it or overwhelmed by it, to go ahead and give it a second chance.
That's a good idea. I agree. I've always loved those books, but I need to read them again and again. My recommendation is I came across this the last couple of weeks. I came across this thing called the Anselm Society, and it is a group of Christians in Colorado who are inaugurating a renaissance of the Christian imagination, especially in the church. And the bit I've seen so far, I like a lot. Some friends of mine have spoken for them at some of their conferences. They do a lot of public programs. They do a lot of artistic programs. They describe themselves as a local community and a larger network dedicated to the renaissance of the Christian imagination. As you can listen to them on their website, theanselmsociety.org. Two of the people that I know that have spoken for them are Tony Esselin, Anthony Esselin, and Corey Latta, who's a Memphian, and both of them have very fine lectures that you can hear on their website, and they're introducing me to a lot of other people that they're working with through the Anselm Society that I think very highly of. So as I listen to them, so I'd recommend that to you, the Anselm Society.
All right. Well, that's all for today. We'll catch you next time. This has been From the Center, and see you later.